In this linear view of history, it is all progressing toward a grand climactic end, a catastrophic end in the eyes of Augustine, that history comes to a dramatic, a catastrophic, and a cataclysmic close, at which time Jesus Christ, the incarnate God, receives all power, both in his mediatorial in his mediatorial activity as well as in his role as the second person of the Godhead. Secondly, this means then that there are no accidents in history. There's no such thing as an accident in history. The word accident really is of a Greek or Roman origin. I don't mean now the cognate, but I mean the idea is a part of the doctrine of chance, which I admit is an Arminian doctrine brought within the evangelical church. But there's no possibility of chance in God's governance of his world. So that what happens to any civilization is not by chance, but by divine ordinance. If you'd like to read, I saw that the bookstore downstairs does have a few copies of my book on Toynbee. Now, I'm certainly not urging you to buy it. However, if you read that book on Toynbee, my criticisms of Toynbee are not those of the usual critic, but rather in the sense that Toynbee has vastly misused the whole Christian position. And in trying to point that out, I bring in some of the Augustinian view of history simply as a corrective to Toynbee. But there's no such thing as an accident in history.
What is the name of my
Toynbee, a study, and a critical analysis of Toynbee. It's a PNR book. I think it came out in 67, I think.
We had a number of copies.
Which means then, and of course Toynbee would agree with this, that the civilization do arise and fall. Which means, however, we should not regard the collapse of any civilization as a tragedy. For if there is no chance in history and there's no fate in history, then of course there can be no tragedy in history. We need to think about that. And if I were giving a course in the sweep of Western civilization, I would point this out. But I would simply point out that so many people, including the Romans, felt that the fall of Rome was a tragedy. Actually, it was a great blessing. It was a great blessing. Rome had done its work so far as the church was concerned. It had provided 200 years of peace. It had provided 200 years of good transportation. It had provided 200 years of linguistic unity. A person knowing Latin, a person knowing Greek, was well fortified for preaching the gospel throughout the Roman world. And I think as Dr. Smith brought out, I think it was he that day, brought out the fact of the Philippian jailer. When they suddenly realized what they'd done, oh, it was the young man the other night, when they realized that they'd beaten a Philippian jailer, that was no joke for them, because Paul could always appeal to Rome. And in the first century A.D., an appeal to Rome would have put the peculiar status of Philippi in very serious danger. And if you understand Roman law and the difference between, let's say, Ephesus on the one hand and Philippi on the other in their status as a Roman colony, to have this brought into question, to have Philippi denied to Paul the right of a Roman citizen, was a very serious offense against Roman law. And one which even the emperor could not easily tolerate. And the Philippians were very much aware of that when they found out what they'd done. They took a very different view of the matter of having beaten Paul up. It was no fun. So that Rome had done its course. It had done its work, and its many sins were now to be visited by a fall. But you see, what happened was this. And in the fall, which people regarded as a tragedy, Augustine said, that's no tragedy. Of course, he didn't see what was going to happen, but looking back on history, we can see that Augustine was more right than he knew, because the sinews of a new culture, the sinews of a new civilization, were being born. Rome was worn out. Rome was done. It had mismanaged itself economically. It had debased the currency. It had allowed the army to fall in the hands of the barbarians. And it had passed severely restrictive laws on the nature of one's work. It had mismanaged itself, become a bureaucracy, and like all bureaucracies, it fell. So the fall of Rome was internal, as Augustine clearly pointed out. But what Augustine did not live to see was the fact that the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Franks, the Anglo-Saxons, the Lombards, the Burgundians, although barbarians in the Greek sense of the word, namely they weren't Greeks. They were hoi barbari. They were not barbarians in the sense that they lacked the appreciation for Roman culture. As a matter of fact, we know from many Roman sources that the Franks in particular were very appreciative of Roman culture. And thus, when they came to the empire, obviously, there was disturbance, there was destruction. You can't have a vast migration of people without that. But much of it was retained. The foundations were left so that with new blood furnished by the Franks, the Anglo-Saxons, the Normans, and the other groups, the new blood, the new intellectual virility, mingled now with the new theological currents of the Christian church, a building on the foundations of Rome that were left, provided medieval culture, which incidentally were not a Dark Ages. Those are fighting words in my vocabulary. To regard the Middle Ages as dark is to seriously and grossly misrepresent the Middle Ages. To begin with, they did a remarkable job within the short space of not over 500 or 600 years at most of rebuilding Western culture. A Western culture which had many, many facets which were far better than classical culture. Let me show you what I mean, just in brief, as a prelude to what I'm trying to say. No culture has equaled or surpassed the medieval cathedral as an expression of architecture. The Middle Ages produced the university. Modern universities are a grotesque caricature of their origins. The University of Paris was a solid intellectual institution. Now, I'm by no means saying I agree with Thomistic synthesis. I believe I've made that very clear. I do not agree with it. However, neither do I think that St. Thomas was the only professor at the University of Paris. The University of Orléans, Bologna, Cologne. By the end of the Middle Ages, there were 80 universities in full operation. Some, like Paris, a sprawling university of perhaps 10,000 to 15,000 students. Others, like Wittenberg and Erfurt, with much smaller numbers. But nevertheless, they turned out a steady stream of great scholarship. You know, Harvard University could use a St. Thomas. They might not want him. Probably wouldn't. But they could use him. He was a great scholar, with for only 325 pounds. His great colleague, Bonaventura, who seldom weighed over 120 pounds, was equally a great scholar. And these men were by no means the only great scholars at Paris. And I would pay tribute to Cambridge and to Oxford, which emerged somewhere about 1200 as universities in England. So that the medieval university was a tremendous contribution. The medieval cathedral was a tremendous contribution. And I shall go on and point out in later lectures the contribution of law of the Middle Ages. Just let me make this observation, that the Middle Ages were the only period in human history in which the dominant political philosophy did not logically and almost necessarily produce dictatorships. Now, I'm not saying there were not dictators. Frederick II was a dictator. I'm speaking of the Holy Roman Emperor. However, his dictatorship was a gross contradiction to the law of the German Empire, not the product of it. Constitutionalism in government is a product of medieval political theory and, of course, medieval theology. So that the Roman Empire fell, but it was not a tragedy. Out of it came Western culture. Today, as I shall show you, we are witnessing the last dying gasps of Western culture. Many people regard it, of course, as a tremendous tragedy. But I remind you that in the Augustinian Calvinistic view of history, it is not a tragedy. The Western mind has come to its end. And Augustine saw that very clearly for the Roman mind, as he nicely reminds the Roman people that their religion has played them false, their philosophy has failed them, their government has failed them, their economic system has failed them. Indeed, Rome failed them. And Gilbert Murray, by no means a Christian scholar, has put his seal of approval on Augustine when he said that the classical period failed, Rome fell, because classical culture lost its nerve, its zest, its nerve to live. Now, I'm continuing this Augustinian view because wherever there may be chaos today, the chaos is not accidental And it's not the product of fate. It's not the product of chance. But rather, has it been brought to pass by the will of God through the actions of evil men, even as they crucified Jesus Christ upon the cross? I cannot solve the mystery for you. I don't pretend to. But in this fact, I am confident that the 97th Psalm is still true. The Lord reigneth, let the people rejoice, and the isles thereof in the world. Now, today then, we face the question of how did we get where we are? And I tried to tell you yesterday, but we first must understand where we are to understand how and why we got there. Now, may I say, first of all, that the problems facing this country today, and I think that this was the real thrust of the question which you asked me to answer, the American problem, was it not? Is not unique, for all of Western culture is suffering from the same malady. We're all in the same boat. Perhaps it has not hit as hard as it has hit Europe. France, as you know, is in serious condition. Germany is in desperate condition. Great Britain is in a desperate condition. Italy is in a desperate condition. The Netherlands is in a desperate condition. All of Europe has been gripped by a vicious disease known as existentialism, which has, of course, been the finishing touch to Western culture. I tried to point out to you yesterday that we are now witnessing the final triumph of the Renaissance in Western thought. It has gained the ground, it has gained the conquest, humanly speaking, within culture over the Reformation. I'm not for a moment suggesting the church is defeated. I am suggesting that the dominant thrust in Western culture is that of the Renaissance. However, this is the ironic situation, that the rationalism which characterized the Renaissance has now eaten up the Renaissance, because the rationalism of the Renaissance has now produced the groundswell of irrationalism. Modern culture has become totally irrational, including much of modern theology, probably all of it apart from the Reformed tradition. You see, the Renaissance brought back into the bloodstream of the West the vicious poisons, the lethal poisons, the deadly virus of Platonism and Aristotelianism. Now, I would grant you that if you want to see the best of paganism, read it in Plato. It's far better to read it in Plato than in his modern idealistic followers. Always read Plato in the original, not in modern idealists. There was no possible agreement between the Renaissance on the one hand and the Reformation on the other, but many people did not see that. So, Western culture, reaching its heights in the expression of the Reformation, was caught in the middle of a conflict between humanism, which became naturalism, and the historic theology of the Reformation, brought to its fruition in the hands of Calvin and those who surround him at Geneva. I point out to you today that modern philosophy departed more and more from any resemblance to a biblical point of view until it has come today to the nadir of despair, until it has simply yielded to the demands of its own irrationalism and has come to the conclusion that even philosophy itself is not possible. Now, modern Europe is in the hands of one kind of dictatorship or another. Have you ever thought to think that a larger percentage of people and a greater number of people today live under some form of totalitarianism than at any other time in the history of the human race? The population of China, whether it be 700 million or 800 million, I'm not now worried about which figure, but simply write down, say, 750 million. The 250 million who live in Russia, the X number of people who live in West and East Germany, the population of Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Yugoslavia, add them together. Add the peoples of continental Europe. For as sure as I'm standing here, the totalitarian power is gaining ground in all these countries. It will consume them unless certain steps are taken. And it will consume us unless certain steps are taken. So that as we transfer the picture from Europe to America, I would look at it with you from, first of all, the political point of view. Then I would look at it from the economic and the fiscal point of view. Then from the social point of view. Then from the educational point of view. And then from the point of view, shall we say, the total culture, the arts, literature, and so on. The 20th century has been the age, and is the age, of dictators. You say, oh, but the French had their Napoleon. True enough. But while Napoleon was an absolutist ruler, he was not a modern dictator. He might have wanted to be. I would not say he didn't have that in mind, but he never achieved that degree of absolute rule. England had her Charles I or Charles II or James I, but they were not modern totalitarian rulers. They were absolutists, but they were not totalitarian. The 20th century, for all its progress, is the age which can boast of totalitarianism in the most unmitigated, most dangerous form that we have known in the West since the days of Diocletian and the late Roman Empire. The democracies of the West are sick. They are sick unto death. And the shadow, perhaps the lengthening and the growing shadow of this totalitarianism, hangs heavily over the American scene. Perhaps more heavily, I should say, perhaps more quickly succumbing than most people realize. You see, the democratic philosophy has always been, and must always be, the open invitation to totalitarianism. John Cotton, writing in 1630, he was Puritan colleagues, issued a very interesting question. And the question which he said was this: if the people govern, who shall be governed? Democracy produces anarchy, and anarchy produces totalitarianism. It's a very simple triad of formula, and it has never failed to work. And I would have you think throughout these hours of this political question: if the people govern, who shall be governed? Thus, the philosophy of democracy has done its deadly work in this country. And has done it so thoroughly that out of it, there will be a totalitarianism, unless, and I shall offer some remedies at the very end of these lectures, unless certain remedies are taken, they will be painful. And I would not have you think otherwise. But not to take them will be more painful. Democracy, in spite of all its vaunted greatness, has robbed our nation of a sense of greatness. It has robbed our nation of a sense of purpose and of destiny. It has robbed our nation of leadership. And ironically, as we rapidly approach now the 200th anniversary of the founding of the country, there is no great sense of leadership, no great leadership emerging, which can rightly use what could be a very meaningful type of observance. But we have no great political leadership. Curiously enough, those people who are taking the lead are trying to restore and to magnify, yes, to deify, the very political philosophy which is the cause of the present problem. This shows their lack of understanding of what it's all about. For our political philosophy today, such as it is, has brought us to our present impasse. You see, what they're really trying to do is to cure our national disease with additional doses of the virus which brought about the disease. They're adding malady to malady and calling it a cure. For the most part, they are the blind leading the blind out of the land of Canaan back into the desert from which they say they brought us. The present political situation I'm speaking about in 1974 is an eloquent testimony to the crisis. Let me ask you a question. You know, there have been suggestions that we call another constitutional convention. And this is seriously put forward. I raise this question. Okay, suppose you do. Who will serve him? Now, I'm not trying to say that all the men of Philadelphia were giants. I'm not trying to say they were all equally great. There were 55 of them, 56. But let's go through the roll call for just a moment. From New York, a fellow by the name of Alexander Hamilton. From Massachusetts, a man who's not very well known, but who was a Puritan of the Puritans, Caleb Strong, who served as governor of Massachusetts for 11 consecutive terms because he had the absolute confidence of the people for his integrity. A very, very able man. From New Jersey, William Dickinson. Unfortunately, he's been, William Livingston. He's been badly overlooked. From Pennsylvania, Robert Morris, a man of great ability, great integrity. James Wilson, a great lawyer of the day, a man of great ability and great integrity. He had a sharp tongue. From Maryland, a very interesting character, a man of great ability who has been badly overlooked, Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer. He's a very interesting person. He had a cousin by the name of Daniel Jennifer, who was a known rogue and rake. And so he legally had his name changed, the man I'm speaking of, had his name changed to Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer to designate him from his cousin. And I do not remember the number of duels he fought with people who did not call him Daniel St. Thomas Jennifer. But it was a dueling offense to omit the full title. And several people got shot for their carelessness and tongue. But he was a man of great integrity, fiery of temper, and equally able with dueling pistols. Another character from Maryland, a very interesting character, who had a great deal of ability, although he had many defects, was Luther Martin, who served for some 60 years at both Maryland bars, the legal and otherwise. But he was a man of great ability. From Virginia, James Madison, overlooked because of Thomas Jefferson, who was not at the Philadelphia Convention. Edmund Randolph, the later Attorney General, first Attorney General of the new nation. From North Carolina, Hugh Williamson, a very able person, William Davy. And then the great group from South Carolina, John Rutledge, and the two Pinckneys, Charles and C.C., who were unusually able men. I've mentioned but a very few of them. John Dickinson from Delaware, who has been badly overlooked, who was one of the great lawyers of the day, along with Rutledge, and along, of course, with James Wilson. Now, when you look at these men, I've only called a few of the roll call just to let you see who was there. If you were to get a convention elected, if they were to agree to it, where would you get your Hamilton? We could use him in Washington, let alone the convention. Where would you get your Madison? Where would you get your James Wilson, the great lawyer? Where would you get your Caleb Strong, your John Dickinson, your John Rutledge, your Hugh Williamson, your C.C. Pinckney, your Charles Pinckney, so on, your Robert Morris, your Thomas, St. Thomas Jennifer? So where would these men come from today? They wouldn't. And the interesting thing about the situation of 1787 was this, that as many able men were not in the convention as were there. Let me show you. John Adams, a man of tremendous ability. If you don't believe me, ask him. He would tell you. John Jay, one of the great evangelical voices of his day and barely overlooked, the son of French Huguenots, who incidentally was one of the founding fathers of the American Bible Society. It was actually founded by his son. But John Jay felt that they wanted a man of name to be the president, so they put him in, although actually his son was the real instigation for it. But he was in the original group, along with the Secretary of the Navy, Mr. Smith, and they founded the American Bible Society. It's interesting, isn't it? The Secretary of the Navy would found the Bible Society. He was unique in American history. Let us go on to Robert R. Livingston of New York. He wasn't there. He was elsewhere, serving as Attorney General of the state of New York. Thomas Pinckney was not there. John Adams was not in the convention. He was serving elsewhere. John Jay was serving as Secretary of State. So that many of the great men, men of unquestionability, were not in the Philadelphia Convention. You can go down the line. I did it, and I picked out about 50 men in the 13 states who were equally able with those who were there. It would be difficult to get 55, and to get 110 or 100 would be virtually impossible. There were many, many men who were thoroughgoing evangelicals like Elias Boudinot, another French Huguenot, Henry Lawrence, a French Huguenot, Arthur Middleton from South Carolina, he was an Englishman, but he was not a Huguenot. But there were many of the Huguenot group in South Carolina, men of great ability, who were doing other things. So that the Philadelphia Convention did not represent the sum total of the political leadership of the day. We're suffering, I say, from political leadership. Suppose you had been living 124 years ago, and you'd been in the federal Senate up in Washington. You had been greeted by John C. Calhoun, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, the great triumvirate of Webster, Clay, and Calhoun. But that didn't exhaust that group. There were other great men, John Bright of Indiana, Jefferson Davis of Mississippi, Senator Chestnut of South Carolina was there, Senator Bell of Tennessee, Crittenden of Kentucky, and then a man who had just come into his own, who again has never been given the fair treatment that he deserves in American history, Reverdy R. Johnson of Maryland, probably one of the last of the great Maryland lawyers, but a man of tremendous ability, who voluntarily came to the legal defense of Andrew Johnson and was the great legal mind in the defense of Andrew Johnson's impeachment. One of the really great legal minds of his day, and who only was a member of one bar and not two, from Maryland. You would have been greeted by other people in the Senate at that time who were perhaps not the equal of Webster, Clay, or Calhoun, but who nevertheless were men of very superior ability and who would be impossible to duplicate today. We don't have them. There were able men in the House that we don't have today. And there were able men who were not in Congress. I shall mention them later. Rufus Choate, the great lawyer from New York, from Massachusetts, Chancellor Kent from New York, who were in legal service. Men who were in the ambassadorial corps, of great ability, who have never received the treatment they should have had in American history. I'm just mentioning this because today we are, of course, dealing with gigantic problems, and we gaily send pygmies to deal with them. Where in that day, with the problems much less serious, we sent giants to treat them. Now, I shall show you later why this is true. You see, as I shall make it very clear when I discuss this in detail, modern education has virtually put off any possibility of leadership. The modern public school is designed to prevent the emergence of leadership. It is devoted to the production of mediocrity and has done a magnificent job. So exactly what it's done. And so we have no leadership. And the men who are important, as distinct from being leaders, are not necessarily great men. As a matter of fact, I have very serious questions about them, from their mental point of view, their training, not to mention some other aspects of their life. You see, today, government is rapidly expanding its power into every avenue of American life at a time when it is least equipped to use even the power which is rightfully its. And so we're giving it more power in order to create greater problems. And politically, we're being starved to death. If you don't believe me, go up and sit in the gallery of the House of Representatives and watch them in action. This is an education, not for them, but for you. You will see something which makes Barnum and Bailey, well, you wonder why you would spend the money to go to that. then this is free. Same thing's true of the Senate. There are some able men in the Senate. I would not deny that. There are some in the House. I don't mean to say they're all equally unable. There are some men who would compare favorably with those of a previous day, but I wouldn't run out of fingers counting them, in my opinion. Now, let us go to the economic and to the fiscal. Today, we're living in a very, very peculiar economic situation. It's a dichotomy in which, on the one hand, you have inflation, on the other hand, you have all the earmarks of a recession. And yet, these two trends are fighting each other, as they never have before. This is because you have men in Washington who do not know what they're doing. And you have a people who are following their advice when the advice is very bad. I would just say here parenthetically, every time you buy a government bond, you're slitting your own throat. You're cutting your jugular vein financially. There's no worse investment than government bonds, because every government bond a day becomes oil on the fires of inflation because of the way the Federal Reserve System is being misused. And bankers know this, but they're powerless. But the government itself is stoking the fires of inflation. It's fanning the flames. It is producing inflation for its own purposes. It has taken over the control of the monetary system and is misusing it. And this is one of the very serious problems. And, of course, the inflation is producing the recession, which, of course, is directly contrary to what Lord Keynes ever thought when he thought. So that economically, we are undergoing a very dangerous inflationary spiral at a time when you're having the rest of the economy in a receding state. Our political leaders have no idea how to handle it, and even those that do have some idea are afraid of it. They don't know what they're doing. Our fiscal leaders don't really know what they're doing. You see, back in 1934, Roosevelt was sold a bill of goods by Lord Keynes, the English economist, who at that time could not sell his theories to the English government, and so he found a market in Washington, and they bought it. And I'm not here necessarily to discuss Keynesian economics with you, except that they don't work. And what the people did not realize was this, that the very liberals who bought Keynesian economics were buying war. Keynes himself admitted that the only final way to keep the economy going under his economic theories, his fiscal theories particularly, was to have war. And in 1941, Roosevelt discovered that. And so he had war. It was very carefully planned. And since then, we have relied upon inflation and inflation and inflation. And now the Nixon administration ran out of political tricks, even as Roosevelt ran out of political tricks. Of course, Kennedy ran out of them. Johnson ran out of them. And other presidents ran out of them. But Nixon has had to take over all the inherited problems which have come down to us from Roosevelt. Practically every problem we have today began with Roosevelt, who was incredibly ignorant, as well as being incredibly a liar. It's a question which was worse, his lying or his ignorance. But when you put them together, you have a national catastrophe of gigantic proportions. You see, liberalism has no answers to any problems, whether it be political, social, economic, intellectual, philosophical, or theological. It creates problems. It has no answers. I love W.T. Jones in one sentence in his great work, The History of Western Thought, in which he says that the history of philosophy is the history of ever-enduring questions and ever-changing answers. And liberals, as long as they have rabbits in the bag, pull them out and call them answers. But sometimes you come to a place where there's no more, where there are no more rabbits in the bag, and then you have a problem. Today, inflation is virtually out of control. And this is our fiscal dilemma. You know, this happened in the French Revolutionary period, and Louis XVI had a series of Secretary of the Treasury. They were bankers then, Necker and Cologne and so on. And he finally listened to one of them And one of them sold him on the great idea, Cologne does, that the way to get out of debt is to borrow more money. And Louis did. And it cost him his neck. Literally. The French went through a period in 1788 and 89 where they could not, first of all, they repudiated the interest on the national debt. Then they took the next step and repudiated the debt. And this is the final solution for most of these problems that governments try, along with, of course, debasing the currency, which we've already tried. And the result, of course, for Louis XVI was the familiar story of bankruptcy and then revolution. So we come to, it's a dreary picture, I admit, but if you're going to have a remedy, you must know the disease so that you can apply the proper remedy. The proper remedy is not more spending. The proper remedy is not more government. The proper remedy is not more education. The proper remedy, in my opinion, is less education. And that may astound you. I mean, the kind we have today, which goes under the title of education. So let's go on. We've looked at the political field and found it wanting. We've looked at the economic field and we found that there too. We have sent forth pygmies to tackle gigantic problems. And, of course, the moral corruption is another problem. So let us look now at the social problem. Need I point out to you that the whole social fabric has given way? I'm not speaking merely of the revolutionary movements on the campus and in the streets. That, of course, is a serious sign. I think I told you that a friend of mine whose name I cannot reveal, and I can't say much about him because I'm pledged not to, and I'm afraid that Bob would know whom I'm talking, told me that when the New York Times and the NBC television were putting out pictures of the horrible student riots in New York City, a particular time that they stormed City Hall in New York City, that the whole thing was a fraud. That NBC and the New York Times paid Negro students to stage a riot. The first time, though, it was bad because they staged it too soon before the TV cameras could get in action. And it upset the NBC newsmen terribly because they paid for it and couldn't get the cameras on. So they had to stage the whole thing over again to make it coincide with the TV cameras. And this happened on several other occasions. These whole things were planned and staged. I just threw that in for what it's worth because it did happen. And it can be very carefully documented. And this will happen in many other places. Did you ever stop to wonder how the TV cameras always happened to be just where the riot was? Didn't that ever make you question about this coincidental effect of a riot and a camera? You know, the TV cameras are hard to get around. If you have, they were going to TV our commencement, because we had Sam Irvin there 2 weeks ago, and they found out that it was too hard to get the cameras in the auditorium with 1,250 people there, and so they had to cancel a TV deal at the last minute. But it was a hard thing to do, and they had about a week's notice. And yet these riots come up spontaneously, and yet on that spontaneous moment, you always have a TV camera. Most unusual coincidence. Need I point out to you of the social breakdown of our day? I think it's evident. I'll tell you a story that really tickled me. I have just finished doing a book on the history of the National Council of Churches. And you may remember that the National Council was confronted by the Black Manifesto and a group of Negroes under James Farmer. And they stormed the office of the National Council and sat down, pounded the desk, and I nearly died laughing when I read it. Because Edwin Espy, who was he just retired as secretary, was the victim of this attack. And they came down and banged the table and said, "We want you to reorganize the council and we want you to resign." And of course, Espy had been long active in the revolutionary and the communist movement. And I saw a letter of his, which he wrote to the other staff members and to the rest of the board of the National Council, which he said, "Did they think I was going to resign my office?" He said, "I'm not going to resign my office because they demand it." And he went on and used some other strong language. And he was furious with them. Because when it came home to them, he wouldn't have thought to give up his job. He made it very clear, and he didn't. I'm pointing out to you the social decay, not only in morality and the sexual line, although that's obvious, but in the broader aspect, the decline of the family, the decline of social customs, the decline of just plain manners. Perhaps I shouldn't say any more at this point, but I think we have seen recent exhibitions of it, which you might want to think about. Let's look at our literature. Have you ever stopped to think how little great literature is being written today? This is true in England, it's true in France, it's true in the Western world. Have you ever stopped to think? I pointed out, not as recently in this lecture, that in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, we had a tremendous amount of very able political leadership. This was characterized also by probably the greatest period in American literature. Men who wrote well, men who wrote enduringly, men who had something to say and said it well, some better than others. But we admit this. England, with its great days of Palmerston, Disraeli, Gladstone, and the other men with whom we're familiar in so-called Victorian England, and a little before that, a little after, had a tremendous literature. No one would deny that in his right mind. Today, the literary scene is a vast Sahara desert of a meaningless jumble, of existentialist dribble. In this country and in Europe, most of it's incoherent. We don't have great literature today. We don't have the great newspaper editors that we once had. Whether you always agree with it or not, we did have men like Horace Greeley, James Gordon Bennett, 120 years ago in the New York papers. We had Robert Barnwell Retton of the Charleston Mercury. We had men, other men, the Louisville Courier Journal, even in that day. Great newspaper men who made writing an art in the realm of the newspaper. We had good magazines. We had Harper's 120 years ago, which was much better than today. We had Scribner's. We had the Atlantic Monthly. They were all well and working. We had the Southern Literary Messenger, to mention another great periodical. We had the DeBow's Review, another great periodical in the state. Today we don't have any of that. Not at all, or very little of it, I should say. Our newspapers, our magazines, our novels, our poetry are all in a very, very sad condition. They are corrupted. Look at our music. I say rather hear it. What great music is being written today? Whether you would reproduce a Beethoven or a Bach or a Handel or a Liszt or a Mozart or a Schubert or a Brahms or a Purcell in England. I'm just picking a Gounod in France. I'm just picking out a few. Servet Elgar. Whom would you offer today as a replacement for these men of music? I ask you this. You see, contemporary literature is completely inane, but more than that, is dedicated to the irrational. Contemporary music is dedicated to the irrational. And it is irrational. And what bothers me terribly is in many, many sectors of the Christian church, we have allowed this to take over, as they did at Montreat, to allow the irrational use of music, or the use of an irrational music, to express the glorious meaning of the Christian faith. And many, many so-called Christian radio stations have devoted themselves to the spreading of this type of junk. And it is junk. It's not only junk from an aesthetic point of view, it's worse than that. It is blasphemy in the sense that it is using the irrational in music to express the doctrines inherent in creation and the meaning which God has given to all his reality. And we are busily at work destroying it through the use of pagan music. Now, this may seem to be harsh, but it's true. If you stop to examine it, you'll see that this is true. Modern church architecture is expressing the irrational in architecture. You see some very, very grotesque churches. And what are they doing? They're using the philosophy of meaninglessness, existentialism, to become relevant in the realm of architecture, and they're highly irrelevant, as is much of our church music, highly irrelevant, as is much of our writing, highly irrelevant, because it is dedicated to the expression of the irrational. And it's wrong. Now, I haven't finished with this, where we are, but I've simply tried to bring some of the aspects of the degeneracy of modern culture. What is my thesis? At this one point, I would agree with Spengler in his Decline of the West, and with Toynbee, that every culture produces its own civilization, and that when a culture declines, inevitably, the civilization dies because it's no longer nourished by the appropriate culture. And you cannot have the death of Western culture without the ensuing death of Western civilization, because you cannot maintain a political machinery unless you understand the political philosophy which produced it. You cannot maintain music unless you understand the laws of music. You cannot produce great art unless you understand the laws of aesthetics in art. And you cannot produce great literature unless you understand language. And today they are busily reconstructing language into this new, what's the name of that new English they're putting out now? They're trying to sell. I forget the name of the thing. Anyway, it's junk. As well as the so-called new math, an attempt to overcome the laws of mathematical reality instituted by God. So our culture today is in a state of rebellion. It's in a state of lawlessness. And it has consciously adopted lawlessness as its fundamental presupposition. And therefore it produces lawlessness and decay. And I think I better stop there.